Hi, my name is Manny Wolf. What I do is I put visionary coaches and speakers on stages, help them to grow their businesses, and I am a guest today on The Inspiring Show.
Welcome to The Inspiring Show with Paul and Jennifer Hensel, featuring inspiring interviews with thought leaders, storytellers, entrepreneurs, influencers, and legacy builders just like you. Learn from experts about finding your voice, mastering your mindset, and creating movements with your message. Tap into timeless wisdom and today's top strategies for transcending to new levels of success, happiness, and joy.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing? This is Paul Hensel, and I'm one of the hosts from The Inspiring Show. Thanks for joining me today. Today's guest on the show is Manny Wolf. Manny Wolf is a speaker, speaking and charisma coach, best-selling author, and a communication consultant. Manny teaches entrepreneurs and high performers how to deliver their unique message to the world with power, passion, precision, and persuasion. He is a sought-after communication and presentation coach because his coaching goes much deeper than any simple technique. He teaches people how to rewire themselves to love and embrace public speaking. Manny trains the leaders of tomorrow to pay it forward and make a positive social impact. So enjoy my interview today with Manny Wolf. Awesome. Well, welcome, Manny. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. Now, you have had to overcome a tremendous amount of adversity to get where you are today. So could you please share with our listeners your story?
Sure. The cliff notes, I guess, is I started out, I was born into a cult, and I was indoctrinated from a very young age into some really heavy kind of like conditioning, I guess. We'll just call it conditioning. It's brainwashing is what it was.
Yeah.
And the big rub, the big catch 22, the big challenge was that it was very, very antisocial. It was sort of like we were against everything that common, you know, normal society, whatever that means, mm-hmm. tends to sort of, agree with. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if I had stayed in that group for my entire life, it would not have been an issue, but, I had to go to school and I had to like, at a certain age, I had to get a job and things like that. And the problem was that I really had all of my sort of social cues were backward. Mm. Everything that I thought everybody believed in and agreed with turned out, you know, put me at odds with everyone I would sort of interact with outside of the group. Most potently probably was the money piece. That was probably okay. The biggest issue. And everybody has heard some variation of, you know, money is the root of all evil. I want to just take a minute here and use this platform to say, no, it isn't. Yeah. No, it isn't. It's not. But we took it one step further. I mean, I was literally taught that the devil, the physical being the devil, was using money as the primary tool to basically destroy the world through capital. That's what I was. And then, you know, sort of really just force-fed that doctrine. And then when I was 14, with no explanation, required to go out and figure out how to make money and get money. So at that time in California, you couldn't even work till you were 16. And I think it's still probably the same. And so first of all, I had to figure out, how do I even get a job? Yeah. And second of all, I had to reconcile why. Why am I doing this? Like, this is crazy. I'm doing the exact thing that I have been taught all my life will destroy me. Mm. And in my case, it led to that. And some of the other things that were sort of given the green light in that group were drug use was okay. So another one was infidelity. They didn't value what I might call like conventional relationship. And so when I was 14, I was interested in girls. When I was 14, I was interested in partying, all of those things. And so I just sort of took off like a rocket, you know, like sleeping my way through every girl in the neighborhood and never really getting that it was hurting people. I think the first time I got loaded was at 12, and I never had a sober day after that until I was 28.
Ooh, that's a long time.
So it was a long time, and a lot of it was during a very young part of my life, obviously. You know, I mean, I was regularly loaded in middle school.
Wow. Yeah. So when you're growing, your brain's continuing to grow yet. So here you are pretty much, you know, drunk, whatever, high almost every day of your life, but then you're being taught all these things that are backward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That it turns out that's one of the main features of a cult is they have a set of beliefs that is obviously not in line with whatever normally, and let's use a bell curve to define instead of putting a value. We'll just say where 80% of the people's opinions tend to fall. Not only are they not in line with it, but they tend to be antithetical, right? There tends to be a lot of a strong antithetical kind of thrust to the ideology, to the belief system, to the agreed upon values and norms. And one of the reasons that's so effective is because we need community, we need connection, we need people. And so if the only people you can connect with are in the group,
right,
the group has a built-in insulation against it being easy to leave.
What you were in, those values were completely different. Really comes to, you know, now really what's right and wrong. And I'm sure you were faced with quite a bit of those decisions, you know, from 12 to 28.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right and wrong winds up being beyond a certain point of, well, I guess, I mean, you could say that all the way down to what seems to be, you know, taken for granted as just obvious. Right and wrong is a very tricky concept. Mm. Nobody's the villain in their own story, you know?
Yeah.
But it made figuring out right and wrong, my own right and wrong, my own integrity, my own value, really, really complicated. Really, really a sort of a like a journey through a field of rakes blindfolded. You know, it was really hard to figure those things out and to come to terms with what I believed right and wrong were for myself.
So now that obviously, I'm guessing, led you to what we would say your lowest point. Could you kind of share that moment?
Sure, absolutely. So from, like I said, from a very young age, a lot of drug use. And there was a lot of drug use led to only being sort of fitting in with the outcast. Mm. So I spent a lot of time around on criminals. Mm. And they took me in. They took me in. Strong sense of community, but it was fueled by lots of drinking, coke, crank, and pot. And, you know, and interestingly enough, but we'll take a little detour from that trajectory to say that I went through a period, probably, I think it was 16 to 19 or something, 17, 18, 19, I think is what it was, 16, where I did copious amount of LSD and mushroom, copious, probably in the neighborhood of 300, you know, excursions, experiences. The funny thing is I credit that for somehow giving me the mental flexibility to get through all the stuff that I had to sort of sort out over many, many preceding or following years.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of a, that's just kind of a weird thing that happened. I don't know without those experiences, if I would have been flexible to sort of do the healing and the inner work that I've done. But anyway, so as is often the case with, you know, increasing levels of drug use, I wound up going to jail a few times. I wound up in lots of violent situations. I wound up, you know, getting sort of more and more desperate until right before my 28th birthday, I really hit that point you asked about. Mm. I was homeless. I had my belongings, such as they were stashed at a few friends. It was just some clothes and some trinkets, some beat up old acoustic guitars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I get, I hadn't thought of this story in detail. I'm out on a binge, on a bender with this girl, and we're up for about 3 days. About 5 a.m., we decide we're breakfast. So we're driving her car down to this little diner in downtown that we know. It's 5 a.m., so there's no one on the roads in downtown. And it was in Chico, California. They have a big road that goes right down two or three lanes on each side. It's a big road.
Yep.
There's no one on the road except us and a police car about two blocks ahead of us. So all she would have had to have done was driven in a straight line to the diner. That's it. That's all it would have taken. She absolutely, and she starts swerving all over the road, not knowing what to do, inevitably getting the attention of the police car that was ahead of us, who then circles back around, comes up behind us, arrests us. Off I go to jail.
Hmm.
So that's that was the beginning of the end, which wound up being the beginning of the beginning. She, I go to jail. I get back out of jail. And now I have to, you know, try to get in some sort of routine. So I go back to where one of my friend's houses, where my stuff was. They looked at me like I was a ghost. Like they were legitimately scared. I had no context and no idea why this was happening.
Huh.
And they slammed the door in my face and they wouldn't come to the door again. So I put another person, same thing happened. I want to be mindful of your time here. No, here's what transpired while I was in jail. Okay. This is, if your listeners don't believe this, I understand. I just want to put that out there ahead of time. I get it. So apparently the local paper had put my picture in the paper. They completely fabricated this story about me being like this big drug kingpin. And you would have had to have seen me in those days to really appreciate the comedy of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a two-bit hustler, you know, like I said, I was homeless.
Yeah.
I was by no stretch of the imagination a kingpin. I don't know what they did it for. Only years later did I realize I probably could have pursued a substantial lawsuit again for that. So all of my friends saw this.
Yeah.
All of the parents of my friends saw this. I mean, they basically sabotaged my name in that community, which was not a good name anyway. I was already like, it was pretty known that I was a drug addict. You know, I'm sure that people were just wondering when I would die. And so to have this happen, and they said in the paper, in the article, that I was going to be in, I don't know, they gave a time frame, like I was going to be in jail for 3 years or something. All of this was fabricated, 100%. They just pulled it out of their butts. But when I showed up back into my circle of friends, everybody assumed that I had turned some kind of a deal and that I was now a rat, we used to call them, a narc.
Oh, yeah.
I even had one friend check me to see if I was wearing a wire. So it was crazy, just insane. After about three or four people slamming doors in my faces, I got a little more determined and I finally cornered someone and got some answers. Well, it turned out that they showed me the paper and I figured that part out. When one of my friends saw the story in the paper, he went around and took all of my belongings. So now, in addition to feeling like the whole city is, you know, sort of out to get me, I now feel like I've now got a beef with a guy who's, and I like to say that in a world full of people who pose and posture and act like tough guys, mm-hmm. in that world, there are very few real tough guys. It's really a lot more rare than people would have us believe. And this guy was the real deal. Mm. He was a little guy. He was like 5'9", maybe 150 pounds. He was a maniac. He was just insane. He was extremely violent, extremely aggressive. And so now I'm confronted with, okay, what do I do here?
Yeah.
Right. The word got to some other people about it. Those people turned it into a bigger issue than it was. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to a guy holding a gun in my hand that's got duct tape all over the, electrical tape all over the handle. Mm. And the serial number is filed. And we're making plan to hunt this guy down. Now, for those of you that don't know, the difference between speaking about it with another person and doing it in an act of angered passion, all the difference in the world. One is called premeditated.
Yeah.
It's the only thing going through my head as I'm going through the motion. Like, this is premeditated. Like, this is a bad, bad thing. And I just sort of determined right then and there, no matter what I'm not doing, no matter what happens, I'm not hunting down another person and attempting. And so I disappeared. I just got on the phone as soon as that guy left. I stalled the guy. I told him to come back at midnight. I got on the phone in a full-blown panic, and I found a ride out of town. Literally just found a ride out of town, took it, and never went back again till I had to go back to go to court. That was it.
So, and this is, you were 28, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right before your 28th birthday. Now, you're born into a cult, but really from the age of 12, you know, like you talked about earlier, drinking, drugs, everything like that. I can only imagine you're just constantly kind of searching for something or searching for answers. And this is kind of your life is like a snowball effect until you reached this kind of pinnacle moment.
Yeah.
And now you escape. So would you agree that's kind of your lowest point?
Yeah. There was one other point in my life, the point that ultimately led me to writing my book.
Okay.
That I would say was as low, without it being about whether or not I would kill someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was many, many, many years later. So we have these patterns that we play out. And so this actually will be nice foreshadowing to the mindsets. And some of these patterns are under normal circumstances, 100% imperceptible. And they take place over long periods of time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're like tectonic, right? They're just like, you're never going to catch on to these. One of them for me was that I was entrepreneurial, truly, genuinely entrepreneurial from as young as I can remember. I was always trying to start clubs and start, you know, lemonade stands and just everything. It was almost a compulsion. I mean, I remember trying to start a karate club before I knew any karate. It was just, I wanted to bring people together.
Yeah.
And I only have language for that now. Like as a kid, I didn't understand what I wanted to bring people together. I wanted to teach them something. I wanted to give them an experience. Like that's a huge driver.
Mm.
It's like as down at the core of me as it is, as anything is. And the part that caused the problem was that kind of thing was really not welcome in my upbringing.
Mm.
Also, my father was like that, and most of the people in the cult, my mother included, had really strong mixed feelings about my father. He was admired, but not well liked.
Mm.
So there's a lot of sort of dynamic tension around the issue of my dad, and I didn't get to know him until I was much older. But I got sort of judged and treated like his son all my life.
Mm.
There's a lot of people judging me based on his actions, even from a young age. And so I think the entrepreneurial thing in me really, really rubbed my mother the wrong way. I don't think she'd agree to that. I think if she were listening to this, she would say that's not true. But it feels, and I don't know how else to say this, it feels true. It's not a throwaway sentence, right? You know what I mean? I don't say that casually.
Mm-hmm.
I say that from years of thinking about it and reflecting on it. She never seemed to understand, never seemed to really get it, even though she herself started little cottage industry after little cottage industry. She never seemed to get the tension it put on me to raise me in an environment where money was evil and then force me to work.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back, of course I had to work, but you know, so there was all this conflict there around just expressing what was an essential part of me. That's the point. And so what I didn't realize until, God, I was probably, well, it took me at least 40 years, like 40, was I was trying to meet the approval of my family and do this thing when they were in direct conflict with each other.
Hmm.
I couldn't do both.
Yeah.
I couldn't do both. It put me in a double bind, right? There's no way I could move that wouldn't cause tension.
Mm-hmm.
And so that all sort of came to a head when we all, and I mean all of us, the whole world went through the 2008 financial crisis. And I was in construction at that time, which is one of the two markets that hit first and hardest, you know, and I went through a period of like, God, I think it was like 9 months without a single phone call for work, 9 months with no opportunity to work. And just not grasping it, not comprehending what was happening. And during that time, my family got increasingly frustrated with me. I think out of an expediency, they sort of didn't give credit to the larger situation at hand and kind of made it about me, which led to a cathartic moment where I had in one afternoon, I got evicted. I got my license taken away. I got my car repossessed and I got my power turned off 4 hours.
Mm.
It's just boom. Everything, yeah. just a haymaker. And I wind up calling my sister to tell her about it. And she says, we're going to have a family meeting and figure out how to help you. And I'm going to move through this part pretty quickly. And that my spidey senses tingled at that. I was like, that's not what we do. That's weird. So go to the meeting anyway. Lo and behold, it's just the whole family just shitting on me, just dumping all of their frustrations with me and anxieties about me and everything. And just pulling out stuff that was just like ridiculous and minuscule. And so it sort of felt like a really badly executed intervention that was dressed up as a how can we help you gather.
Mm.
That was actually the best thing that ever happened in my life.
Mm.
Because it made me realize I can't do me and fit in with you guys. Mm. I can't do both. And I didn't see it until then. So that would have been like 2011. So I was born in 1967 and it took me till 2011 to see that pattern. You know, so point is that was the moment where I basically told them all to fuck off and I walked away. And I literally started getting jobs, getting work, changing my life. Everything started like floodgates open. And I believe to this day that it had to do with 100% just like uncoupling from the need to get their approval. And it took this big catharsis to do it because I thought I had done it many, many times in the past.
Yeah.
But what I was in fact doing was I'd pull away for a little while. I'd find some success. I'd come back to the family. The success would crumble. Mm-hmm. And I did this over and over and over and over again.
So you really had to cut ties and really start setting boundaries.
I had to be prepared, which I still am, to say, I got to make a choice between feeling fulfillment, feeling like I'm really going after this thing inside of me, or staying in this group that is increasingly feeling more and more hollow and unsatisfying and kind of like, I love those people. I do. And I realize that that might sound a little magnanimous right now, all these years later, but I do. I love my family, but I also get that, like, that doesn't mix. I can't be me and interact with them. So in the future, something may change. I don't know. Something may shift, but it was that clarity and that letting go and that finally saying, you know what, I'm done. And then writing a story of my life, writing the book of my life in a way that I feel was pretty unflinching. And about myself as well, by the way. I don't mean unflinching like, ooh, I really told it like it was about them. You know, yeah. I told it like it was about all of us, including me.
So really owning your story.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and being very careful not to position myself as a hero or a victim in any part of it, which is really essential. You can't seek sympathy and you can't put yourself up on a pedestal.
Yeah, true. And so the title of your book, I'm going to share that.
Yeah, it's called The Tao of the Unbreakable Man. It's meant as a play on words, but hopefully for those who read the book, you'll understand that when I was younger, my idea of unbreakable was rigid and unflinching and, you know, unwavering. And as I went through all the things I went through, I realized that unbreakable meant more you'll break if you're not flexible, you'll break if you're not supple. You know, the wind that blows the tree over just flattens the reed until it passes, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's the title of the book. And it's also meant to be a testament to, quite frankly, if I'm still standing, like, you can do it too. And I hear so many people say that I feel like easy to sort of lump me in with other cheerleaders, but that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, there are a few of us who know protracted periods of struggle, long periods of struggle. Oftentimes I find that people who really sort of vibe with me and connect with me are sexual abuse survivors. They're survivors of narcissists, right? They're survivors of parents with borderline personality disorder. These people who their struggle was decades long.
Yeah.
And so, I, one of the things I hope to accomplish with the book is to prove through a story, through my story, that like it doesn't just have to change incrementally. You know, the possibility for how your life can change would, should, and will just floor you if you lean into it. The compliment that I get from people who aren't trying to give me a compliment more than any other thing is like, I can't even imagine you as a criminal. I can't even imagine you as a thief and a drug user. The best thing you could say to me.
So this is a good transition now, you know, decades of adversity and now, you know, finding yourself, but you know, that takes a different mindset. That takes some different steps. So you want to talk to us about that.
Yeah. And you know, I people want to know this a lot. They want me to sort of quantify the mindset tools. And even though it's a heavy-handed analogy, and so, but I think it's effective. Your foundation has to be, so I would have said resilience, but I'm just starting to get into this guy, David Goggins. You know that guy?
I've heard the name.
Okay. Well, his book is Can't Hurt Me. And he's like this, he's just a military guy of some stripe or another. And he's just tough as hell. Right. What he says is like, he basically says your mind will give out on you before your body. And so you've got to become gritty. You've got to become just the grittiest, nastiest, most determined, hardcore, just SOB. And I kind of get that, even though that doesn't really fit who I am today. There has to be people, when we talk about mindset, I think people are looking for sophisticated ideas. And with good reason, there are sophisticated ideas in the realm of mindset, but they're built on a really, really simple foundation. You know, I come from the trades and construction. But like I said, back in 2008, I was in construction. And I like the analogy that houses, buildings, right? The world's most sophisticated buildings are built on concrete, which is a very simple foundation. It's a humble, humble material. And yet from it, because it's so sturdy, you build skyscrapers. And really that foundation is grittiness. That foundation is what some people might call resilience. Mental toughness is another popular way to talk about it. Yep. And guys, if you're going through stuff and you're, you know, and I hope this is happening and you're listening and going, that's me, I get that. Oh my God, yeah. You know, I've been struggling for years. Let me tell you, a lot of the mindset stuff is like bloody knuckle. It's chipped tooth stuff. It's staying in it. It's getting back up. And so you see what, you know what I mean? So it, It is mindset, but it's also almost something else. Do you know what I mean? It's almost just a will.
Yeah.
So when we have that, then we can start to develop and apply sophisticated emotional filter. And you know, those are hard to come by too. They're hard won. But if you've got that foundation of not giving up, basically, of getting back up, staying in the fight, I think that's what everyone who has successfully done anything that most people look at and go, wow, they have that somewhere in their psyche, in their psychology. You'll find a toughness.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then from there, I was able to stack on top of that, an ability to look at my own thinking, which as humans, that's sort of, you know, many people, Viktor Frankl says, that's the thing that separates us from animals. It's the ability to think about our thinking. Even though most of us can't do it. We don't do it. we can do it. We don't do it.
That's right.
So that's really kind of what mindset is for me, is first and foremost, it's a willingness to stay in the fight. And I deliberately characterize it like that because for many of us, it's really, really hard sometimes. And so I just want to, whoever's listening that needs to hear this, I just want to support you that if it's really hard for you right now, that doesn't mean that you're uniquely suffering, right? It doesn't mean that you're in some dire straits that no one else has been through before.
Right.
Yeah. It's just a question of, you know, how much endurance do you have?
Yeah. You know, you talked about not giving up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when everything's thrown at you and you're brought to your lowest point, and I know I can relate to that. I think we all can in some way or form, but when it's really, it can come down to it's hard, but it's a decision of, I'm not giving up. Mm-hmm. So in other words, okay, it's giving up and suffering, or I'm going to do whatever it takes to rebound from this.
Yeah. Again, I feel like I want to sort of invoke Frankl. You know, he said that his best assessment was the people who survived the concentration camps in Germany and the ones who didn't could be divided pretty much into two camps, those who didn't give up and those who did.
Yeah.
And this is in circumstances where all of your external liberties have been taken from you. The only thing you have left is what's in your mind.
Yeah.
You could be, a soldier could walk by you and indiscriminately shoot you in the head for no reason at any time. And you're surrounded by people who hate you. So I like Frankl a lot for that because none of us, our lowest low or our most intense intensity doesn't compare to that.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I like what he did. And I did this very same thing, not knowing that Frankl had done it already. I would project myself out into the future I wanted to live.
Okay, good. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. During the hard times, Frankl would imagine himself lecturing at the in university. He would imagine himself teaching future generations of Jewish people how to never again, you know, he had this compelling future.
Yeah.
So I guess that's another important thing too, is to have a compelling future. What a lot of people I think maybe miss is that the compelling future it's a slippery piece, right? Because you just have to decide that it is that. And you'll have to, in many cases, decide it in the absence of any proof that it can come to be.
Yeah.
And I'm here to tell you, in my case, it did. It 100% worked.
Yep.
Yeah.
And well, there's that, you know, there's always that choice, but you made a choice to look at the opportunities in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You started looking at where you wanted to be and not at the obstacles, because when you focus on that, that's all you're going to see. So then, you know, you start seeing light at the end of the tunnel, a little bit of momentum, and you're able to build from that foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in my case, there was baffling setback after baffling setback after baffling setback so many times where, and this is where that concrete foundation idea comes in, where all I had in me was, is today the day I quit?
Mm.
Seriously, like looking in the mirror and going, no, today's not the day I quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is today the day I quit? No, today's not the day I quit. Can I take one more step?
Yeah.
Like, and then let me tell you something about being programmed to think that money will destroy you. You go out into the world then and money is so essential to our lives, and you now either can't make it, or when you make it, you manage it so catastrophically irresponsibly, you know, and that was my life. It toggled between those two things. I'd have these periods where I'd make lots of money, but I would just spend it all. And I would refuse to open my bills and things like that. And so you go back and forth between these kind of extremes, and you really get a sense of how important it is. And so for me, I think probably the hardest one for me to uproot was the connection to my money belief. And then after that, so here's an object lesson for whoever needs. Another thing you have to do, and this is like a mental filter, like I talked about earlier, you've got to be able to assess when it's time to stop staying in the old story. I think for a lot of us, we'll overcome a tremendous amount. And because that's the life we're used to, is that life of overcoming, we're still in overcoming mode, even though there's not stuff to overcome the way there used to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And that was me with money for a long time after I had pretty much, like, you know, I had gotten it all out of the way. I'd fixed it all, so to speak. And the only thing keeping me struggling with money was that I didn't realize it was time to let go of that story that I had to overcome it. Yep. I didn't realize I had crossed the finish line. Like a delirious, here you go. It's like a delirious marathon runner who just keeps running past the finish line, you know, and you don't know that it's time to quit. So, boy, I wish I had a teachable tool for that one, because for a lot of us, we spend a lot of time in that sort of, you've actually overcome everything. All you have to do is stop not knowing that you overcame everything. You know,
I think it's you know, we can get stuck in our stories, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Get stuck in that point, and it's when you realize, okay, no, this isn't the end. Like, I can change what I want to change in that story. I can make a new story right now.
Yeah.
And you did that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's transition to, tell us about how you're helping people get their story out to the world.
Great. It's kind of like no accident that now I'm heavily involved in the work of getting stories out into the world. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. I look at that often and I'm like, huh, look at how that worked out. You know, that's funny to me. First thing to understand, just as a conceptual sort of idea for people, is the way that cultures, big, little, the way that groups, the way that cliques, the way that niches are formed is so simple, and it's so hard to detect. It's just agreement with a narrative. Like, that's all it is, right? So if you're, it's nice and divisive. If you're pro-Trump, right? It's just an agreement with a percentage, a certain percentage of the narrative that he creates. If you're anti-Trump, you know, let's say you're going as far the other way as you can and you like Bernie, right? It's all you have to do is just have a complicit agreement with the stories that he creates. And once you make those agreements with yourself and they're silent, you don't feel yourself making them, it changes your speech patterns. And so other people who agree with you instantly recognize you. Without you even having to say, I believe in Bernie or I believe in Trump, you know, it doesn't even matter. You just, that's how easily it works, right? So for me, that period between really having functionally fixed my money shit and realizing it was about realizing I was still telling myself that story. And so what I did was I started very actively and very vocally and very, and meant to be really sort of polarizingly, I started calling out on social media, on live streams, all of what I perceived as the BS around poverty consciousness and the so-called nobility of poverty and all that stuff, right? Mm. These entrepreneurs who want to change the world, but it's not all about money? Get the fuck out of here. Of course it is. You know, it's like, even if you look at Gandhi, you really look at Gandhi or Mother Teresa, and you'll find that millions of dollars moved in those movements, whether Gandhi got money or not. Money is part of it's the grist for the mill, right? Change doesn't happen without money, not on a big scale. So now, interestingly enough, I've been working with story at this big metaphysical level and this big spiritual level. And now, like, my work is helping people who are, what I define them as visionary, you know, like I said in the beginning, I define them as visionary coaches, authors, visionary speakers even. And really, what do all those people have in common? They've got a story they want to get out on a bigger scale. Yeah. So that's what I do. I'm probably best known right now for my Opus program. And that's literally a program that finds you the speaking opportunity.
Mm.
And we have a guarantee, and it's really great. And we guarantee we'll get you a minimum 5. But really what we're doing is helping to push meaningful stories out to a bigger audience. And now that you've sort of been given my take on how stories function to create unity and to create groups, hopefully you can see, not you, I guess, I know you can, but the audience can see why it's important to me on more of a calling level, on more of a mission level, to help these people with these visionary people get their stories out, right?
Yeah.
Because if I can get 100 people, you know, as an example, to get their story out in front of thousands of people each,
yeah,
it's really kind of cool. What's happening is then I become like a candle and I'm lighting thousands and thousands of candles without ever diminishing myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you're owning what you've been through, mm-hmm. and now you're using that to help other people. Like you came out on the other end.
Yeah.
And here it is now. Yeah. This is what you want to give back.
Yeah. And I think, you know, those that I would say are visionary, that's really what we all want to do. I think it may look different. It may be a different product or service. It may be like the details may be different, but I think by and large, we want to take what we've learned and help others.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there's a really attractive purity.
Yeah. Well, totally. Yeah. I mean, really the situations we have all gone through to get where we are, mm-hmm. are different, right?
Yeah.
With everyone, but there's similarities in stories that we can draw from where people can say, you know what? I'm not alone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's a whole really rich discussion on the art of storytelling to be had, you know, now that you bring that up. How do you tell your story in such a way that people hearing it feel like you're telling their story? Mm. And there are some great tools for that. But yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea. Sometimes when I get a little disillusioned with, you know, like social media really shows us a nice bell curve of humanity. Mm. Wouldn't you agree? Yeah. And as has been the case for a long, long time, the two edges are the loudest, right? And so we tend to sometimes conflate that with being what's real, but it's actually less real by virtue of how many people agree with it than the middle, which is quieter. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I can get a little disillusioned because of social media, but what I always do to sort of bring myself back from that is I'm like, I pull back and I look at how many people are in my world who are working their butts off way outside of the lines of convention, right? You know what I mean? Like way outside of what the normal workaday mentality is. And they're really trying to bring something positive in some way to the world. So when I kind of pull back to that 1,000-foot view, I used the analogy of me as a candle earlier. I realized there are like thousands of candles out there all trying to help light other candles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would go as far as to say social media has accelerated the collective consciousness. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to commit to that. I think that's true. Now, it has also shines a light on, you know, a lot of like idiocy, a lot of like trolls and stuff like that. But whatever. So what?
That's right. You can use that how you want to use it. If you want to use social media for good, it's a great way mm-hmm. that you can do that.
Yeah.
You can reach way more people.
Well, and I, because of social media now, I see people, lots of people who are savvy and successful and bright in their like 20s, you know, like when I was in my 20s, I did not come across people like that. Therefore, my worldview was that there weren't people like that at that age.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's accurate or not, but when we can see younger and younger people doing more and more good, you know, making bigger and bigger impacts, that gives us permission to keep hustling, to keep grinding, to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
And through that kind of process, the whole conversation elevates, the whole collective consciousness has an opportunity to rise up.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, thanks, Manny, for sharing. I want to ask you one question before we get into our speed round. If there's one lesson that you could take from your life and share with our listeners, what would that be?
It would be the analogy of the concrete, the humble concrete slab being mm-hmm. what you build the masterpiece on. You know, it's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how it's supposed to be. And then, by the way, guys, girls, it doesn't stay hard.
Yeah.
Not as hard as it is in the beginning.
That's right.
I think that's really important too, right? It's not like my life right now is unrecognizable from my old life. Mm-hmm. And I do have struggles. I do have challenges, but it's nothing. It's like an order of magnitude less than what it used to be.
Yeah. So yeah, when you're looking to find a way, it's not forever.
Right. It's not forever. Yeah. You are moving upward, even though at times you don't maybe perceive it as that. And so it comes back to that.
I think, taking two steps forward and one step back, you add that up, it's still progress.
Yeah. It's still one step forward.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So awesome. that would be my one takeaway is like, you know, just because you have the skill and the talent and the gift, that alone is just table stakes. That just gets you in the door, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's important to understand that. And so now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And without exception, the people that get the success and the awareness and the personal brand or the credibility that you're after have put in work to get there. And if they're telling you they haven't, I would be distrustful of them. Yeah.
All right. Well, Manny, we're going to get into our speed round. I'm going to ask you five quick questions and you just give me the first answer that comes into your head.
Okay.
Okay. So what do you do for fun?
I play the bass. I like to work out and just get outside, you know, like it's pretty humble. It's pretty simple stuff.
Good. Good. Yeah. I like that. What's your favorite quote?
I don't have a favorite quote. I can give you a good quote, but I don't have a favorite quote.
Okay. Here, give us one.
So one that fits what we've been talking about here is, I know of no more heartening fact than man's ability to raise his station through nothing more than simple determination.
Oh, nice. Who's that by? Do you know?
I want to say Chardin, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, that's a good quote. Now I want to ask you, who has inspired you the most?
Hands down the most, without question, Stephen Covey.
Okay.
Awesome. By a mile. By a thousand miles. I don't think there's anyone else I've come across who's in the same.
Cool. What is your favorite book?
7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Good.
Yeah. Like or my own, but for different reasons. Can, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
100%. You can say your own book too.
I love my own. I love my own because it was such a mind blowing catharsis to create it. So healing. It was transformational.
I relate to that when I wrote my book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really healing to kind of own what you've been through.
It was some powerful stuff. Yeah,
it is. And it's also really helpful to get to that next step, right?
Absolutely.
It's like, okay, it's here. Now I can kind of move on from that, move on to something else. Awesome. And what's a really good tool or resource that you could recommend to our listeners?
Well, I want to give your listeners a free copy of my book.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Does that count?
Yep.
Okay. Then feel free to read the story of someone who knew what it was like to really struggle through life for well over 40 years to finally achieve, I would say, nothing less than a complete transformation.
Awesome. Now, is there a specific link?
I'll give that to you. Yeah.
You'll give that? And yeah. We'll make sure to put that in our show notes.
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. So now how can our listeners connect with you further?
Good. I get asked this a lot and I think that maybe, it's so simple that people get a little confused. Just look for me on Facebook.
Okay.
And if we're not already connected as friends and you send a friend request, that's wonderful, but also send me a message saying why.
Cool. Okay.
Because like many of us, I get hundreds of friend requests a day, a week, you know, and those who identify why they want to be friends with me, I tend to always make room. I mean, I'm pretty omnipresent, especially on Facebook. That's kind of my hangout,
you know? Yeah. And you're on there a lot.
Yeah. And so you'll find that I'm extremely accessible.
Cool. Awesome. Well, great interview. Thanks for sharing your story, Manny. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. Thanks for taking the time and, giving our listeners a little bigger piece of Manny Wolf.
Yeah.
I like it.
Cool.
We appreciate you taking the time and we'll let you know when we'll air the episode. And if you want to share that would be great.
Absolutely. I'll make sure that thousands of my people see it.
Cool. And we'll make sure we'll put all your links or how to get in touch with you in the show notes and everything else.
Perfect.
All right.
Okay. Well,
thanks, Manny. Nice to meet you in person.
Likewise.
And take care, my friend.
Okay.
See ya. Well, thanks everyone for joining me today with today's interview with Manny Wolf. Wow, very interesting and unique story and great tips around coaching and speaking. Really enjoyed that. Now, you can access all the show notes of this episode on our website, inspiringshow.com. Now, please also join our Facebook group, follow us on Instagram, and you can find all the links to that at theinspiringshow.com. Also, if you would like to join as a friend of the podcast, we would love your support. And you can click the membership in the menu of our website again at www.inspiringshow.com. Now, thanks again for joining me today. And until next time, remember, you have a story and your story matters.